The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
And it's something that has been debated for a really long time. When Congress is not acting on these things, that means the Europeans will. And we've seen that on the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation. We're going to see that when it comes to artificial intelligence regulations. And so when we're not stepping up, that void is going to be filled by others. And when somebody else is filling that void, we may not like the outcome.
I'm Alvaro Marañón, fellow in cybersecurity law at Lawfare. And this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 30th, 2022. The era of the global internet offered opportunities for economic and political progress, but it has also afforded bad actors the opportunities to manipulate and leverage this interconnected system for the worse. Over the past decade, there has been an increase in internet shutdowns, ransomware, and cyber attacks. But despite these growing challenges, there is still an opportunity for collaboration around the preservation of an open internet. To understand what the current state of cyberspace is, I sat down with Adam Siegel and former Rep. Will Hurd to discuss the Council on Foreign Relations' latest task force report entitled Confronting Reality in Cyberspace, Foreign Policy for Fragmented Internet. Adam was project director for both the 2013 and 2022 task force, and Will was a member of the 2022 task force. We discuss how the cyberspace environment has changed from 2013 to now, the differences in attitudes and approaches between the two CFR reports, and what the United States needs to do to reverse this trend around fragmentation and to preserve the benefits of an open internet. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 30th, reflecting upon CFR's reports on U.S. goals in cyberspace. Adam, can you tell us a bit about the CFR and what led to the creation of the first task force?
Sure. So CFR is a nonpartisan, independent foreign policy think tank. Take no U.S. government money and no U.S. No official positions. And the 2013 task force, I think, was really motivated by the need to introduce the national security and economic interest of cyberspace to foreign policy thinkers, and to introduce them to the threats, the risks, and some of the concepts that were shaping U.S. policy at the time.
And for those unfamiliar with the timeline, what were some of the risks that were shaping it? I know there were a lot of revelations at the time, attacks. For those who are a bit unfamiliar, that'd be great.
Yeah, so in the 2013 period, we were kind of in the wake of the revelations about the U.S. operation against the centrifuges and Natanz in Iran, so Stuxnet, or also known as Olympic Games. The back and forth between the U.S. and Iran. So Iran had conducted a widespread distributed denial of service attacks on U.S. financial institutions. We saw wiper attacks against Saudi Aramco and another oil producer. We saw, in particular, Chinese cyber espionage directed at the U.S. private sector, but also against Defense Department networks and the White House and State Department and other networks. And generally kind of rising cyber crime broadly, and the beginning of what we would think of as the fragmentation or the splintering of the internet, more countries blocking content or forcing data localization.
And we can get into the internet aspects of that. But before we dive into that, Will, can you speak about your perspective about the current cyberspace and how you joined the task force?
Well, I was excited to join the task force. I had just come out of Congress, where for 6 years I spent time working on cybersecurity policy, looking at emerging technology and dealing with the issue of privacy. And so to have this amalgamation of former government officials, academics, think tankers, that all have, you know, great backgrounds in this space was exciting. And for me, when I look at 2013 versus now, in 2013, I was still working for a company called FusionX. We were building a company that does technical vulnerability assessments, penetration testing. One thing we weren't talking about then was ransomware. One thing we weren't talking then was really the Internet of Things, right? We were talking a little bit about bring your own device. That was an issue. And so we weren't really talking about supply chain attacks. That's completely different now. And ransomware is evolving. There's a stronger connection now between geopolitical risk and cyber risk. And then the lack of security innovation is giving attackers a chance, a leg up over defenders. And so this is why I think CFR was perfect for looking at this report, because of this growing trend between a connection between geopolitical risk and cyber risk.
And when you read these two reports together, Adam, they're a bit stark, at least the 22 report. The last 8 or 10 years or so have been pretty negative, I would say, in some aspects. But there's still a period of optimism that you guys speak about. Could you branch out on this?
Yeah, I mean, the 2022 report basically looks at the data gathered by people like Freedom House and Access Now that shows, you know, basically internet freedom has declined every year for the last decade, seeing a lot more content moderation, seeing more blocking, seeing more countries just shut off the internet when they have to because of contested elections or communal violence, and, you know, rising cyber threats. That is, as Will mentioned, we definitely highlight the ransomware threat. But I think the 2013 report really kind of captured the sense of optimism about cyberspace at the time. You know, at least a quarter of the report was about all the good things that came from the open internet. Social activism and political activism and economic growth, and also optimism about what the U.S. could accomplish in that space, a sense that working with its allies in the private sector, that the U.S. really had a set of policy tools that could shape the future of the internet. And I think the 2022 report is, you know, both shaped by what's happened over the years, in particular the 2016 election interference and spread of misinformation and disinformation, and a growing kind of reality about what the U.S. can do on its own and with its friends in the face of China, Russia, and others who have different interests in cyberspace.
I was just going to say, when you look at, I believe it's the first sentence, right, Adam, the era of the global open internet is over. You know, that's pretty, that look, when we started talking about that, it made me uncomfortable, if I'm being frank, because, but as we were working through this report and doing our work, it's the reality. And if we don't accept reality, we're not going to be able to make sure we're protecting digital infrastructure in the United States, that we're working with our friends. And that's why we want to be very clear up front about the successes and ultimately some of the failures of policy to set some stage for the future. But for a lot of people that have been working on this issue for a couple of decades, this was a pretty tough sentence to agree with.
And before we dive into the specific findings and pillars, what exactly is global internet freedom for those unfamiliar with this area?
Yeah, I mean, I think the shorthand was an internet that was global, open, interoperable, and secure. In fact, that was the 2013 report, was defending a global, open, interoperable, and secure. And I think when people talk about the fragmentation or the splintering of the internet or the increasing controls on the internet, they're talking about different levels of the stack, right? So in some ways, content has always been more tightly controlled. I mean, from the beginning when China connected to the internet, it blocked off certain types of content and prevented US firms from operating freely in the domestic market in social media. And even our European allies, you know, you're not allowed to sell Nazi paraphernalia in Germany and France. And there were types of languages that were controlled. But what we're seeing, I think, over time is both the strengthening of those controls and the spread to other countries and a split further down the stack. So we're beginning to see countries preventing suppliers from potential adversaries from participating in domestic markets. So that global side of it, I think, is really fracturing. And the openness is harder. It's still, I think, for the most part, for most individual users, it still seems as if it's a global internet. You can still, you know, for the most part, surf around depending upon where you are. But that split is, I think, moving further down the stack.
And we've seen in recent years, a lot, like you said, a lot of political turmoil. You see countries shutting down the internet for periods of time, and it's a scary trend. But now shifting to another finding, you have 12 total here. Data obviously appears, and it's a source of geopower. Will and Adam, can you both speak about its role in competition?
For me, one of the areas that I spend a lot of time on, have in the past and in the future, is artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence, to me, is the equivalent of nuclear fission, right? Controlled, you have nuclear power. Uncontrolled, you have nuclear weapons. And the core of all of this is data and the availability of data and who gets access to that data and who controls that data. I'm of the opinion that anything I do online is mine, right? And I should be able to determine how that information is used. And, you know, the government's access to that should be the equivalent of the government's access to, you know, my papers and effects at my home. And so whoever, you know, the rules on how you control that data and give access to that data is going to determine which philosophy is going to govern a lot of these technologies. Is it more in line with the Chinese government, where privacy doesn't matter, or is it more in line with the United States and the European Union on this? And this is one area where the United States and Europe, needs to get on a little bit better page, because we're closer together than Europe is with China and other authoritarian governments. But what you're able to do with data, And not only is it just the data, is it your ability to control the infrastructure on which that data transits, right? And so these are two areas that when we look at our foreign policy, we need to be making sure that standards and international setting bodies conform with our view of protecting people's information.
Yeah, I think so. One of the other interesting things about the 2013 and the 2022 report is the framing of China. And in the 2013 report, the threat really from China is, as I mentioned before, cyber espionage and commercial espionage, as well as blocking the domestic market. But in the 2022 report, China is behind a lot of the things we're talking about. And I think that this point about data and its role in national security is in part driven by how much work the Chinese have done over the last decade to create a national strategy about data and how they're going to use it, how they're going to gain access to it. Now, you know, there's lots of debates about how successful the Chinese are going to be in that, and implementation is not the same thing as having a strategy and all of that. But I think the way that the China challenge is framed in the 2022 report is just much broader. It goes from everything, you know, to who is designing chips and semiconductors to who is helping shape the global rules of who has access to data, and as Will said, international standards and a whole range of things. And so I think that point really is a kind of a signal to US policymakers and our allies, as Will said, to the Europeans and others, that we really need to engage in better coordination and have a more organic, comprehensive view of what we're doing in this space and how we want to shape it.
Yeah, absolutely, especially with signaling other countries who are developing their own approach to data. You know, we have the Western, we have authoritarian states, but a lot of countries are developing on their own. And if we come out with a unified voice, I feel like that brings a lot of utility. And another area you speak about in the report is how the US has taken kind of a backward seat around digital trade. And one area that I kind of look at is the executive. You know, we have declarations around the future of the internet and other broad statements. How do people interpret this, or how does this coincide?
Well, part of it, you know, is just reflective of the U.S. pulling back from international agreements. And so I think, you know, certainly during the Trump administration, when it pulled out of TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it removed itself from some of those discussions, particularly around digital trade. Now, you know, there were other bilateral agreements that were helping shape that space, but they were not having the same impact. What we've seen, I think, under the Biden administration is a whole range of kind of areas where they're willing to talk about it. So, for example, the Quad, right, the security discussion between U.S., India, Japan, and Australia has discussions on AI and cyber and norms around cyber. The Indo-Pacific framework is going to have a digital component. But because the U.S. is kind of removed from these larger trade negotiations, and right now that's bipartisan, you know, there's just no appetite really for big trade agreements. And it's harder, I think, for us to shape those discussions without having a kind of comprehensive view, which is, you know, particularly our friends and partners in the Asia Pacific want. They want to know what they're going to get in return for these digital agreements.
And we also speak about, or at least the report speaks about, the importance of having a unified voice and how the U.S. kind of has failed to deter attackers. I would like to speak about that because from the outside, the perspective for the layman, they'll see how sanctions have been active. You know, we've had takedowns of botnets. It seems successful. We have takedowns of Tornado Cash, listing sanctions. It seems like we're doing well, but every day we see new ransomware attacks.
Look, I would say that one of the successes of the current administration is some of the aggressiveness that they've pursued in dealing with these bad actors. You know, retrieving the Bitcoin from earlier in this year, or maybe it was late last year, and making sure there's consequences to these behaviors. One of the things that we address on is, you know, not only is it about delivering consequences, we got to make sure that every country has rules on the books and laws on the books to prevent this kind of stuff from happening. And if they're not taking the steps to prevent their country or some of their cities from being the starting point of some of these attacks, then they're almost as equally liable for this problem as who the attackers are. But that goes back to what Adam is saying. We have to engage to talk about what we think expectations are. What are we going to do? What are our allies going to do? We can't bury our head in the sand. We got to have friends. We have to have allies. And this is not just about the United States and our allies achieving our best selves. This is about us making sure that we are engaged in a fight, and the fight is with the Chinese government. And so we have to have, people got to know what the consequences are, which means we have to build up our capabilities to deliver those consequences. And, you know, a debate on this always comes back to attribution. And for me, knowing that I don't need to know that it's Colonel, you know, Oleg in the Russian SVR that did this. All I need to know is that the Russian government sanctioned this. And so I think this is one area where us and our allies need to get more on the same page about how do we deliver consequences.
I think there was a little bit of tension actually in the report and some of the task force members about this finding about, you know, what sanctions are useful for and indictments. And, you know, the report basically says they don't have much of an effect on our adversaries. They're more important for drawing our allies together and kind of drawing a common line together and saying these are the types of things we're going to respond to. I think there were some people on the task force who thought, actually, no, you know, the sanctions and the indictments certainly have a tactical effect, as you said. Earlier, you know, the botnet takedowns and some of the other things have certainly slowed in some instances the pace of operations.
But they're quite reactive. Like, yeah, they're collaborations responding instead of being forward looking. Yeah.
Yeah, they're reactive, but they, you know, they do something. And I had somebody, I was, you know, socializing the report and somebody made a very good point to me that also what the sanctions and the indictments were also useful for explaining to kind of third parties some of the norms and how we're going to react. And so they pointed out that was particularly true in Southeast Asia and ASEAN, that it kind of signaled to them you know, oh, the Russians and Chinese are kind of breaking these rules, and we now see it more clearly. But I think, you know, the idea that it, one, as you said, it's been primarily reactive, and two, long term, it really hasn't made us, you know, much more secure. We're still facing these incredible risks from the attacks, and the norms and the sanctions are not going to stop it.
And it's only going to get harder with a splintering of the internet, right? You know, with a decoupling that we're seeing. You know, are we even going to be able to use financial sanctions in the future if there are multiple systems or different systems? So this issue only gets more complicated as the splinter net grows. And so this is even more reason why we have to build a trusted, protected internet coalition to make sure that us and our friends know what we're doing and be clear on that.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
So the report, Will, Adam, you both identify three pillars for foreign policy to guide the U.S. approach. You spoke about inner coalition. Can you speak about the other two in greater detail? And we can go from there.
Yeah, so the second one kind of tries to walk the line on this tension between sanctions and other efforts to shape our adversaries' behavior. So the framing is essentially, we should find useful sanctions. We should continue to disrupt the operation. So basically embracing cyber command and defend forward or hunt forward operations. And there are going to be some restrictions on what the US does. Or we should signal to our potential adversaries that we are willing to discuss some limits on behavior to ensure greater stability, and that probably should be in everyone's shared interest. And those revolve around election infrastructure, so no destructive attacks on election infrastructure, no destructive attacks on the financial system, and then nuclear command and control systems. Now, again, it's hard to imagine how we're going to have those discussions with the Russians and the Chinese right now, given the current political situation. But the argument is that that's going to be in all of our interests, right? And we still managed to talk to the Russians, the Soviets, at the height of the Cold War, on things that were in all our shared interests.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add to that, it's the more I read and learn about that period in the 70s and the 80s at the height of the Cold War, and the fact that we were able to negotiate disarmaments agreements on a nuclear arsenal, it's mind-boggling that was actually possible. And so I think while we recognize how difficult this would be in this current environment with some of our adversaries, this is something that we need to, and our allies need to articulate. And the third point, the third pillar in the report was get the U.S. House in order. And, you know, one of the things that we talked primarily about is the need to bridge the gap when it comes to cybersecurity talent. There's not enough people that have the skills we need. And the number in the government of cyber, the need for cybersecurity professionals is an outrageous number. And it starts with making sure we're creating that those folks that can help us defend our own infrastructure. And then I would even say my former colleagues in Congress need to get their act together and pass a privacy law. Right? This is like the first letter of the alphabet, right? And it's something that has been debated for a really long time. When Congress is not acting on these things, that means the Europeans will. And we've seen that on the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation. We're going to see that when it comes to artificial intelligence regulations. And so when we're not stepping up, that void is going to be filled by others. And when somebody else is filling that void, we may not like the outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a definitely great benefit in the cyber domain with being the first mover. But in particular, legislation, it seems positive, or at least we're optimistic that finally comprehensive privacy legislation is coming through. I remember being in law school in 2017 and everyone talking about how excited they were that it was around the corner. And even then, 5 years later, it's still around the corner. That's fantastic. So regarding other types of legislation, we spoke about the workforce issue. Retention's a major issue with the cyber workforce. We can recruit people, but keeping them against the private sector or other things is a big challenge. What are some other legislations that you would look out for to address domestically?
This is slightly outside of the task force report. And really, our goal in the task force report was to focus on the foreign policy aspect. It's the Council on Foreign Relations. And one of the things that we suggested and is happening is having a senior person within the State Department be the coordinator of these kinds of activities. I don't know, and Adam, you may have some sense of Nate's appointments and whether how that's unraveling, or unraveling is not the right word, how that is proceeding. But for me, it's how do we create can we create a position within government at the high end? Let's say some great entrepreneur just had an exit event from their company and they have some time to figure out what they want to do next. How do we get that person in the government to work on really tough challenges, right? There's some financial things that when you come in the government, you have to do and have to get rid of that may not make sense in order to get that kind of talent in. How do we get people at the other end that are coming out of university? Can we improve scholarships for people that are getting a cybersecurity degree? Then they're going to come and work in the government. And then when they go out into the private sector, can we loan them back in the government, kind of like the way we do the reserves? And that's something that is within the realm of possibility. And I know there's been some initiatives to get this cross-pollinization of ideas. You have the private sector get to pay folks what they deserve, but they can come in and the government understand some of the unique challenges that the U.S. government has, which will then be used to apply tools for the government to get better. Because ultimately, the government needs to start, being this notion of buy, not build. That's actual strategy and how procurement is supposed to work. And ultimately, we need to be making sure that to deal with some of these authoritarian governments that are targeting us, where those countries can move all factors of production in one direction. The government and the private sector have to be working and collaborating in a way in order to be able to defend against those kinds of threats.
For those the listeners who aren't familiar, the co-chair of the task force, Nate Fick, who worked with Jamie Misick. So Jamie had spent a long career inside the intelligence agency, inside the CIA. Nate was in the Marines and then was a private sector cybersecurity, and he is the Biden administration's nominee to be the ambassador for cyberspace, the head of the new digital and cyberspace policy bureau inside of the State Department. I watched Nate's hearing in July, I think it was, or early August. Everyone seemed very supportive, given his private security background and his private sector background. I think they were very enthusiastic about how he could engage the private sector in these issues. I think Nate made it clear that the State Department hasn't really been playing a larger role in the interagency as it should have been over the last 4 or 5 years. Right before, in the Obama administration, there was a cybersecurity coordinator who reported directly to the secretary, but there's been a long move, both supported in the Congress and the Trump administration. Rex Tillerson had a plan for creating a cyber ambassador, and Secretary Pompeo also created a plan on his way as he left the department. So there's been a lot of talk about it for a long time that we need this role. And so I think Nate was very clear that, he sees his mission as bringing state back to that interagency and having it play the role that it should. I think the other thing we talked a lot about is when we think about foreign service officers, what skills and knowledge and expertise that they have. And so the analogy we used is that, as you make your way through the Pentagon as a military officer, right, you have to have joint experience, right? You have to have some time where you served with other services, and so you understand the joint process. So one of the recommendations we made is that cyber has to be like that, right? If you're going to make your way up through the Foreign Service, you really have to have some time, experience, exposure to digital and cyber issues.
Multidisciplinary, which I feel is the cyber domain's dynamic.
No, Alvaro, absolutely. And not even multidisciplinary, specific experience in that discipline. And in the State Department, you have cones, right? When you're a foreign service officer. So, I was a political officer, so I hold the record for CIA officer that wrote the most State Department cables. All right. I had a lot of work that I had to do on behalf of the great State Department. And you have political cone, you have economic cone. I even think there needs to be one where it comes to a technology cone. And it's not just purely cyber. It's talking about other technologies, because oftentimes what happens is the skill sets that's needed to negotiate many of these kind of multilateral agreements or to participate in these standard setting bodies. We have to bring people from Washington, D.C. to go and participate in these things. But we need folks on the ground in Brussels, in Vienna, that can work on these issues, and that they can stay focused on these issues throughout their entire career. And that's something that's critically important to, especially when we talk about building trust in that internet coalition.
And it seems right now we're in a kind of an exciting period between the public and private partnerships compared to 8 years ago. We've seen the importance recognition, the importance around collective defense. How much utility do you think this has moving forward compared to other states or other promising areas?
It's interesting. The 2013 report was built around cooperation with the private sector. And also it highlighted a number of partners we thought were particularly important internationally, Germany and Brazil being two of them. Now, the 2013 report came out the day that Edward Snowden showed up in Hong Kong.
Perfect timing.
Yes, exactly. A lot of those policy recommendations were kind of swamped by a lot of the disclosures, the Snowden disclosures. And then we had a period of a kind of a not great relations between the government and the private and the tech sector, right? The companies did a lot to kind of keep the U.S. government at shoulders length, both kind of legally, transparency requirements, also through technology by rolling out, you know, end-to-end encryption. And some of it was marketing, you know, talking about how they were global companies and they had global users. We're kind of past that. I mean, that is, I think, no longer the case. And certainly with the conflict in Ukraine and Russia, we're seeing incredible coordination and cooperation between cybersecurity companies and the U.S. government and others. That said, I do think the task force was kind of less reliant on the private sector in some spaces than the 2013 report was. But I think it has always been one of the great U.S. strengths and will continue to be one of the great U.S. strengths is coordinating in that space.
I can tell you when I first got into Congress, so day one for me was January in 2015. And if you talked about cybersecurity in Capitol Hill, it really meant information sharing. It was always about sharing, you know, what's happening here, what is this potential attack, things like that. Like, we've gone beyond that because here's the reality. The private sector probably has way better information than the government on a lot of these things and are already following this. And now the conversation is around collaboration, right? How do we actually work and develop tools that meet our national interests and our national goals? And that may sound like semantics, but it's a huge difference in 7 years. And I think that is only evolving and improving. And this is one area. There's a few areas of bipartisan agreement in Washington, D.C. One is the threat that the Chinese government plays to the United States position in the rest of the world. And two, I would call it, you know, some people would describe it as cybersecurity. It's probably broader technology and the need and the importance of technology going in the future. There's a recognition in Washington that the technological change we're going to see in the next 40 years is going to make the last 40 years look like we were monkeys playing in the dirt with sticks. And people understand the need to be ready for that. So that's a great environment in which this collaboration between the public and the private sector is only going to continue to flourish.
So there's some political will. There's some optimism. What are some recommendations that we can go forward to, you know, create a brighter future? Trade agreements, international crime centers?
Yeah, I think the more concrete recommendations are, you know, as you mentioned, one is moving kind of slowly building a trade agreement. Probably we talked about, for example, building on the agreement that's between Singapore, Chile, South Korea. So you could kind of start building that out. We talk about an international crime center. So one that has a more operative side than what Interpol does. So because every time we do a botnet takedown, you kind of have to put the ad hoc coalition together of the private sector and different international governments. So could we have a standing thing there? We talk about a international working group on open source, right? So the Log4j vulnerability really
still being recovered to today.
Exactly. Yeah. So we really highlighted those vulnerabilities, and adversaries are taking advantage of that. So that, I think, was a important discussion. I would say those are among the kind of more concrete kind of first steps that we could talk about.
Yeah, pass a GDPR-like piece of legislation so that we can be in line with our European allies, and then lay out, you know, what are our norms? What are we consider to be acceptable? And I know Adam's gotten into that in this conversation, but those are pretty significant steps that would move us further down the road.
And looking forward, Will, what is an area that the U.S. needs to increase its efforts in? I know you spoke about artificial intelligence. I know the EU has a comprehensive act coming out that has some type of Bill of Rights. Is that an area you would be looking into, or maybe even quantum?
So AI for sure. We need to, you know, if again, the Europeans are coming out with something in 12 to 18 months, if not sooner, we should be engaged in that conversation and be leading the world when it comes to adoption on principles on ethical use of artificial intelligence. But quantum, for me, these conversations around cybersecurity are only going to get magnified when somebody achieves quantum supremacy. One of the things I've learned being associated with the intelligence community for the last two decades is that take the assessments that the intelligence community has, the timeline, something's going to happen, and divide it in half. You know, usually things happen a lot quicker than what is predicted. And this, the ability, we all know what quantum, a country achieving quantum supremacy. If one of our adversaries gets there before us, would they be able to keep that secret? And then basically learn all of our secrets, because they're going to be able to break all of our encryption. So moving towards quantum resilient encryption, and again, this administration has passed a number of executive orders on this particular issue. But you know, I remember, Adam probably does too, Y2K, right? I was in college and I was afraid to be on the road that day because I didn't know what was going to happen. And it was nothing. Like, it was a big letdown, because why? We spent $4 trillion in like 8 years working on that issue, as simple as, you know, making sure the date in our computer was proper, right? And so this is a level of focus and attention this quantum resilient issue needs. And look, I was talking to some bankers recently and I brought this up, and I was scared by the number of people that email me after and be like, "Will, I've never heard of what you're talking about. Can you tell us more?" And I'm like, "Yikes!" You know, I called my personal bank to make sure that they understood what I was talking about, make sure my money's taken care of. So, and again, this is a great topic that we can be working with our allies on, and that we can be working on how to solve this problem together. We can be working with Five Eyes, our most important intelligence partners, on sharing information on how to deal with these kinds of threats. And the same principles and theories that we outline here on cybersecurity apply to other the threats of other technologies like artificial intelligence and quantum computing.
My sense is, across the board, if we're looking domestically or we're looking for foreign policy-wise, the most important kind of near-term issue is talent. I mean, just anybody I talk to, no matter what they're doing, how we train the talent, how we retain the talent, that just seems to be the top line from everyone that I interact with. The report basically says, look, two things can hold us back. The first is, you know, Will is definitely right. There's this bipartisan consensus around China and the importance of technology. Unfortunately, that still hasn't been converted into, you know, very fast action, right? Both
semiconductor chips issues and all stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Look how long it took to pass the CHIPS Act. You know, the Democrats and the Republicans are both going after big tech for different reasons. And there is a lot of, you know, unwillingness to give the other side a win, even if it's good for, you know, US national security. So, you know, as you mentioned, Alvaro, we've been, you know, at the cusp of a privacy law for, you know, for many, many years. So there is, I think, a worry that, you know, domestically, we're just not going to move fast enough. And the other is the working with the Europeans. And here, you know, the war with Ukraine and, you know, China's increasing ability to shoot itself in the foot and alienate European partners in particular, but the much of the world, you know, before that, we kind of bought into the idea of China's peaceful rise. we've been able to take advantage of that and coordinate more on tech policy. But there's still fundamental differences about how we should treat data and regulation, and those are not going to be necessarily easy tasks. I mean, Europe is still talking about technological sovereignty and digital sovereignty as well. And so we're going to have to figure out how to address those issues.
But that also could be a benefit, the slow progress from the US. You know, we saw some backlash on GDPR down the road, but the slow process may be a utility, but also it might be a cost, like you say.
Yeah, you have to, you know, the slow process is good when you learn from the other person's mistakes and then you adjust, but you actually have to follow through. It's just learning is, and then, you know, saying, oh, look, that's not a good thing. It's not the answer.
Wonderful. Thank you, Will. Thank you, Adam. And thank you for the council for the great report.
Thank you. It was a great discussion. Thanks for having us.
Always a pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Jay Venables of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.